trying to compensate for my lack of German with humor. So, I do apologize. I don't. I'm not one of those Americans who believes that everybody in the world needs to speak English. I apologize for not speaking in your beautiful language this evening. I arrived this morning from the United States and had to decide how to fight my jet lag. So I decided that I will make this more entertaining, if only to keep myself awake. But then I will stop probably at earlier or sooner than some of the rest of the presenters, because I do want you to engage me and ask me questions, because this happens to be a topic that really keeps me up at night. So I have a lot to say, and not all of it is in this presentation. So to make it interesting and entertaining, in order to keep myself awake, I have tried to weave together a narrative that brings elements from my memoir that Ulrike mentioned, which is really not so much a memoir, but more personal observations and pieces that I put together, but definitely for the first time. So I have often said about this memoir that there are aspects of it that may be imperfect, but in their imperfection, they are completely original. That there are aspects of Iranian Jewish history that have not been recorded at all. I will read a passage from one of those tonight, which is, for instance, a meeting that took place between Ayatollah Khomeini in March of 1979 and the Iranian Jewish leaders, which I report for the first time. So here we are. I begin, and given that I come from America, and my president is not a polite man, I will not be offended if you interrupt me, ask questions, or express boredom at all, because it's okay. And I can stop, I can answer questions, I can go somewhere else if you want me to. So. Am I speaking loud enough?
Yes.
In the mind of every conscientious individual, every citizen who thinks it his or her business to leave the world a little better than he or she came into it, there is always a mix. The mix is made up of intellectual concerns and formative personal narratives swirling together in the pot of our heads. I call this mix of questions, concerns, and narratives our personal moral soups. Key experiences and beliefs all go into this brew. And one way or another, they flavor us into the people that we are, will become, and will ultimately determine the recipe of the lives that we choose to lead. I very carefully, possibly more than most, watch the ingredients of my personal moral soup. The reason is that while in a grand and existential way, we are all part of history and our lives will eventually come to an end, I am also living the end of the life of my community, a collective history. I think I'm running out of water. It is one thing to watch a mother or a father die or move from one city to another. It is another thing to watch a history, a very ancient history, die before your eyes, wiping the record of all one's existence. By this, I'm not simply referring to the emotional aspects. By this, I'm not simply referring to the emotional aspects of such an experience, which are complex and many. For the purposes of this talk here tonight, I'm focused on the idea of who gets to interpret, to be reliable witness, to report or detail such a demise. It is the quality of that observation, the ability to extract fact from fiction, to look fairly at the unfolding events, which make this a difficult endeavor. These are the undertakings that determine the quality of the ingredients that go into the moral soup. Communities come and go. Many are endangered as I speak. Polar bears or Burmese Rohingyas, Christians all over Egypt, Syria, and Iraq are becoming extinct. Cycle of life turns. Injustices occur. We can stop a few, but not most. The irony is that we can always be certain that the world has seen worse. But among all of these contemporary endangered groups, I dare say few are as relevant, intriguing, and still politically important as the Jews of Iran. Why? The reasons are many. To begin with, the story of the Jews of Iran is the story of Iran. It is the story of the survival of the Jewish identity after the Arab conquest of 633 AD. There were Jews in Iran long before Islam came into being. And when the new believers attacked Iran with the intention to get the natives to give up their Persian ways, embrace a new language, as well as a new religion, the Jews spearheaded a serious resistance and became the keepers of the Persian heritage that was under assault. While pre-Islamic literary texts were declared banned, the Jews of Iran began transliterating, meaning writing in Hebrew letters the original Persian works of those texts using Hebrew letters and thereby keeping these national treasures safe from the invaders' harm. When music was declared banned and Persian traditional music was on the verge of annihilation, Jewish singers, entertainers, and musicians who were permitted to keep instruments in their homes and play music for their own festivities kept Persian traditional music alive. Incidentally, the same happened after 1979 when music was banned once again under Ayatollah Khomeini. Iran's musical stars survived this new ban a second time with the help of the Jews. In the United States, pop stars who had fled into exile made a living in those early years by playing at Jewish weddings and bar mitzvahs. In Iran, the stars of the traditional music could either play at embassies or at Jewish venues only. And that's how they sustained themselves for the first few years of the revolution. So it is fair to say that in the nearly 3,000 years that Jews have lived in Iran, much of the Persian literature and culture, music and art, has had to pass, at least for the purposes of survival, through Jewish filter. Therefore, it is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to refer to something as truly Persian without implying that it's truly also Jewish. It is because so much is at stake at the heart of the Jewish experience, and because so much of it is, in fact, the story of Iran itself, that reporting and telling about it has been so difficult. This was the serious part of my presentation. Now I'm going to take you to the moment that this Iranian Jewish community begins to feel that in 1978 that something serious has happened and is about to change. The reason I'm reading this little passage is because what I built up to say was that reporting on Iran and on the Iranian Jewish community has been incredibly difficult. And there are many competing narratives that exist, not only because it's difficult to get into the community and get the facts, but also because the regime has a serious investment in conducting and controlling the narrative that emerges. But in addition to that, reporters who don't speak the language, who are there for only a few days, can hardly access the layers beneath the surface, and that's where the difficulties lie. Now, I found that one of the best ways to fight those difficulties or provide a more authentic narrative was to gather and collect all of the narratives that are going ungathered, unrecorded, and uncollected. In part because, as I mentioned, the Iranian Jewish history in Iran, a history of nearly 2,500 years, is ending, and no one is recording this in a methodical and systematic way. So this passage that I'm about to read is yes, part of my memoir, but also part of my effort to create a written narrative about what happened. So here we are in December of 1978 in Tehran, and I'm at the time only 12 years old, and the story that is circulating throughout Tehran is that there is a man named Ayatollah Khomeini somewhere in Paris, far away from Tehran, in exile, and he is conducting a revolution inside Iran from far away. And I don't know how many of you are aware or remember or have studied that he was very good at creating dramatic social events. And one of these hugely dramatic social events, especially to a 12-year-old that I was at the time, was that as an act of peaceful resistance or protest, he staged night after night, moments where he demanded that people inside their homes turn off all their lights, create a moment of blackness throughout the streets, go to the rooftops of their homes and chant, "God is great," and as the words are in Arabic, "Allahu Akbar." I don't know if you can imagine this, but it is incredibly moving to be in a completely black neighborhood on top of the roof where you don't see faces of the people in your neighborhood, but you hear this angry and solemn voice of only two words being repeated again and again and again for 10 minutes. And this is the moment where my father, mother, and I go to the rooftop, so we are one Jewish family in a sea of non-Jews watching this moment. December 1978. At 8:45 p.m., the lights in the homes began to go off one by one. But by 8:55 p.m., not even the night was as dark as our neighborhood. All but the heavenly bodies had heeded the Ayatollah's message. Under the full moon, the antennas and the tin chimneys emanated a silvery glow, enhancing the majesty of the dark. Nothing hung from the clotheslines, not even pins. The neighbors were on the balconies and rooftops, even the ones who had no intention to chant. Darkness had rendered all faces immaterial. The eye could only see the outlines of the crowd. Some short, others tall, some hunched, a few seated. Those were the cynics who were waiting to see if the night would compel them to join the protest. I hopped over to the dividers between the rooftop and join my parents. My father was repeating under his breath,
Helen, do you see this? For as long as the eye can see. One stinking mullah can do all this.
To commit was what was memorable to mine. My father always needed my mother as a witness.
Shh,
she elbowed him. He teased her.
Try to say Allahu Akbar, Helen, or we will risk irking the goyim.
Could I say Allahu Akbar? The words echoed in my mind, but I could not utter them.
Say it, I urged myself. One, two, three.
But I could not. I had never had to say words in Arabic, to chant in a language other than my native Persian. I had never been expected to sound like a Muslim. Must I choose? My heart was fluttering in my chest and everywhere else. Excitement pulsated in my ears. It throbbed in my belly. I feared something unknown. I was brimming with the thrill of something unknown. My parents were scared, whereas no one around us seemed to be. My friend Z signaled me from the distance, inviting me to join her family. And I found myself torn between staying on our rooftop or going to hers. Suddenly, I envied Z, who was standing with her siblings. I envied their togetherness, their certainty, their eager anticipation for 9 o'clock to strike. At 8:57 p.m., two rocks struck the light bulbs at the poles at each end of the alley. The skitter of the shards against the asphalt in an alley so hushed sounded as if 1,000 glass bottles had shattered. No one said a word. At 8:58, our alley stretched like a common alley, dark and desolate. But at 9, it came to life. Moans of Allahu Akbar billowed through the night. They were not orchestrated sounds, but fitful scattered through the alley. They rose as if every person's throat had been clutched. Their chests heaved with each breath. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Each Allah expanded in windpipes, inhaling air, as if it were rapidly running out. For every gasp, 100 more echoed in sympathy. The Allahs drawled longer with each chant, H's barely fading under the Akbars until all fizzled into a single Allah, greatness slowly sundering, then dissipating in the intoxicated throats. The cloud of a single plea bloomed over the alley. By 9:08, the plea was a desperation, reverberating in his name. Allah and not another word. Allah and it sealed all the untold. Every home a heap of kindling. The alley was a bonfire. Phantom flames had scorched the neighborhood. A thick, sonorous smoke hovered over every home. Every man, every woman, every child was burning. Everyone a victim, everyone an arsonist. So this, I want to take you to this moment now, which is the moment of the revolution. And there are some Persian speakers here who can read the banner, which says, "We separate the business of the Iranian Jewish community from." From the Zionists in Israel, but the original words were from those blood-sucking Zionists in the state of Israel, and so this there's no incident, there's no it's not an accident that this banner came into being. This is a moment from early February of 1979, a few days before the triumph of the Iranian Revolution, and. Or perhaps March, and the Iranian Jewish community has realized that The Shah has gone, and the monarchy has ended, and therefore they have to figure a way of recasting and redefining themselves under this new regime. And so one of the things that and the reason there is a major fear about the survival of the Jewish community after the fall of the Shah, aside from the fact that the status quo was changing and there were a lot of fears in general, and there was a radical Muslim cleric named Ayatollah Khomeini who seemed to be adamantly and vehemently against the government of Israel and Zionists. Aside from all those things, there was one more factor that created a major fear within the Iranian Jewish community, and that was one execution, and that which came in the March of 1979, and it was the execution of a very patriotic but Iranian Jewish industrialist named Habib Elghanian. Some of you may have been following the news of Iran over the past week and might have seen that a building named Plasco in Tehran collapsed due to a fire this past week. This was the building that Habib Elghanian built 60 years ago. So the collapse of the building in some ways was incredibly tragic, more than most other tragedies, in part because the one standing legacy of this man fell apart. And this is a man who played a major role in modernizing Iran. And he was executed, and this was the one thing that had been left. So here's another moment when that brings us to this incredible historic encounter between Ayatollah Khomeini and the members of the Iranian Jewish community who wake up to the news of the execution of Habib Elghanian and are wondering whether everybody else is going to be next.
You should mention he was accused to be a spy of Israel.
Yes.
This was his accusation.
That's right. So the passage that I'm about to read, I think, if I haven't forgotten to put it in, mentions it. And it is from that meeting that this banner comes. So in case I got my dates wrong. And this banner is actually the foundation of the policy that the Iranian government has inherited from a haphazard moment in 1979, a haphazard meeting in 1979 with Ayatollah Khomeini. And this sort of became the decision, whether it was voluntary or involuntary, that the regime made about what it was going to do with the Jewish community. And I think there is no coincidence why we see the banner and we see the words in so many demonstrations and gatherings, as well as walls of synagogues and everywhere else. So here is that. Nearly 3 months after the victory of the Iranian Revolution, in the previous February, the Jewish community woke up to the news of the execution of its leading figure, the industrialist Habib Elghanian. His crime: friendship with enemies of God, Israel and Zionists, and sowing corruption on earth. They were always very dramatic with their accusations. Sowing corruption on earth. What made Elghanian's execution particularly shocking was that he had felt profoundly loyal to and grounded in Iran. His confidence was not his alone. It was the source of the community's confidence too. He had been key in modernizing Iran's industry through, above all, the production of the introduction of plastic to Iran's manufacturing. Because of all this and many more contributions, he had assumed that the nation's gratitude had him immune against any malice. On the morning of his execution, ripples of fear shook the foundation of the community as a whole, and the question everyone was asking was, who was going to be next? Or did Elbanian's faith, like his confidence, belong to all? Within hours, the Jews of Tehran decided to make a most drastic measure of all, to pay a visit to Ayatollah Khomeini at his residence in Qom, the equivalent of the Vatican for Shiite Iran, in the hopes of receiving his personal guarantee about the community's safety. An ad hoc assembly consisting of two rabbis and four young Jewish intellectuals sympathetic to the revolutionary cause were selected for the job. They arrived late in the afternoon and found the Ayatollah's residence, surprisingly empty of the usual throng of disciples. Soon they learned that the quiet was in honor of their visit. Immediately after their shoes were off, they were guided into the press room. When they had at last arranged themselves in a circle on the floor, one of the rabbis addressed the Ayatollah. He congratulated him on his political victory against the Shah and expressed the community's joy in the new order. As every true Persian speech always concludes with a poem, so did the rabbi end his with this verse. In it, the prophets were likened to the sun and the moon, and the wise clergy to the brightest of stars. Then the Ayatollah spoke in the Holy Quran. I'm not going to do his voice, but he always sounded incredibly tired. In the Holy Quran, Moses was a mere shepherd when he stood up to the might of the Pharaoh and destroyed him. Moses, the speaker to Allah, represented Pharaoh's slaves, the downtrodden, the mustazafin of his time. Now, I'm emphasizing the term mustazafin because the moment the Jews heard that Moses represented the mustazafin, they were happy. Mustazafin refers to the downtrodden of Iran, but it was a key term because these were the downtrodden masses whom Khomeini believed he himself represented. So to draw a parallel between Moses and himself as having been the leaders of the mustazafins of the past and the present was a good sign. That day, the Ayatollah ended his remarks with these words: Moses would have nothing to do with the Pharaoh-like Zionists who run Israel, and our Jews, the descendants of the Moses, have nothing to do with them either. We recognize our Jews as separate from those godless blood-sucking Zionists. And so to have created that separation created a measure of safety that the Iranian Jews badly wanted, because they wanted to make sure that Elbanian was an exception, not the rule. And therefore they bring back these words, and they write these words on the wall of every synagogue, every Jewish entity that existed at the time in Tehran, as a reminder to those who were coming or wondering what to do. So I think I've reached the end of my time. Right, Ulrike?
More or less.
Pretty much. Okay. So and obviously I'm someone who can talk a lot. What I hope we can discuss in the Q&As is where's the community now? What happened to it since this? And is there any hope for its survival? So thank you. I'm going to join.
Okay.
Thank you.